Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. Time to come out. He's Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 10. NASDAQ futures down 26. As everybody is, I don't know, do we have enough? The sky is falling. We'll never make it. Where's Chicken Little when we need him? Do we have Kevin? He's not Chicken Little, but where is
Chicken
he?
Large. I'm Chicken Very Big.
Oh, there you go. You're the you're the road runner. You're not the chicken, right?
I would like to think so. Wile E. Roadrunner or something like that.
No, it's Wile E. Coyote.
I see.
Yeah. The
I don't know. I know the Wile E. part applies to me. I'm not sure if I'm Coyote or the Roadrunner.
Did you ever see those guys? Those Roadrunners?
No, I've never seen one.
My my buddy CW had the place out in Arizona. The he had some in his backyard. And we stayed at a place in Scottsdale. By the way, if we ever go down to the Arizona Fall League, we'll probably stay in the same place. They got nice big, kind of like almost condominium rooms. You can watch those guys. And they are the meanest little suckers. They're not afraid of anything. They'll take on a snake and grab him and just shake him around. But they dash from, they can jump about as high, like almost like a turkey, where they can fly up like into a bush or something. They can't just do any sustained flight. But they're fast as hell. Any kind of, if you're a cockroach running around on the ground, you got nothing on those guys. They're on you in a second.
You're lunch, huh? Your name is lunch.
Oh yeah, it's a yeah. They are the meanest little suckers. Nobody wants to take those things on. They'll peck at you like there's no tomorrow. Anyway, the do we have enough news here this morning with all the? And I keep looking at the, and then there was the. I watched some of the games. I turned on the debate. That seemed like 45 minutes of that was enough. Then I think somebody dozed me off, either one of the games or the debate. But
I fell asleep before the debate was over, but that's because I was tired. But I don't want to say it was great, but it was way better than the presidential candidates.
Without a doubt. And it's kind of weird though, Kevin. You look at the news, and yesterday the news was. Oil's going to the moon. Well, oil's up today some. It's up $2. But it's 72. It was 72 last week. It was down to 67. I mean, we're trying to create this massive hype on all this stuff. For whose benefit? We gotta stop people talking their position, hyping people, telling you the world's falling apart. By the way, go buy their stock. I mean, yeah, because people listen to these idiots. I mean, unfortunately, they do. And anyway, I was
a certain amount of oil comes into the East Coast via a cargo ship. So I think that's cause for concern if the strike drags on. But we'll see how that.
I'm not so sure that
there's a lot of other causes for concern if the strike drags on.
If there's an interesting question that. Neither one of us know the answer to. If you come in with an oil tanker and pull up to New Orleans, do you need longshoremen for that? Or do you just pull up to the thing out in the ocean and plug in and unload?
Yeah, so I just filled the gas tank. Maybe that's all you have to do. No, I am sure that you need some ability to unload, but that's a good question because I have not seen it happen. I don't know how it works.
Well, you guys are, when I say you guys, There's a lot of talk on the show sometimes of the, you know, the internet, the news media, and all those sorts of things. And I'm not, I mean, I asked Carl to see if he could find it because he's really good at this stuff. I must have dug around yesterday for until I got bored doing it. I can't find anywhere what the how much it actually costs per container at one of these ports in and out over the last 12 years. And I cannot find out what the rate of pay for these guys and ladies were in 2018, because these are 6-year agreements. And it just there's a bias sort of everything in this world. And the bias in the despite what, you know, a lot of people think it's right, left, or whatever, the bias I think is for big companies. Everybody knows that these guys are demanding 50% I'm sorry, turn down a 50% raise. Nobody knows it's a 6-year contract. That's in line 100. You know, they're going to do fine. It's not up to me to, but the way it goes down, Kevin, it aggravates the living bejesus out of me, to be honest with you. I mean, somebody is taking a side that these guys are getting paid too much. Now, it's not the press's job to do that. And if it was me or you writing the article, we would say, by the way, this 50% raise is over 6 years. Some of it's now, some of it's strung out. And over the last 6 years, their raise was 2%, 100%, whatever it was. We would fill in the rest of the story. You can't find that. I can't. Why do we have to, you know, to lean toward management on this just because because everybody says, hey, I didn't get a 50% raise. What the hell, right?
Well, there's a reason that so much media leans towards management on these issues. And Carl brought this up once, and I think he articulated it very well, because they all advertise on the media outlets, and without them, you know, because there's just not a lot of interest in paying for media. I mean, we do pay for you know, CNBC, for example, because we pay for cable, but we don't see it that way as consumers. It's part of the bundle. But if they don't get Pfizer money, if they don't get Exxon money as advertising, they're cooked. So they need it. They're compromised because they have to walk the fine line of trying to be news organizations and at the same time not piss off the people who pay their bills.
Well, yeah, I mean, but somewhere along the line, this, though, you want, I think,
and it's not that fine a line. They tend to lean on the side of the people who pay their bills.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's I use the term normal, but
well, and I think that has a lot to do with the kind of reporting we get on these issues. It's the same thing that we went through, you know, all the stuff about vaccines and so on. Yeah, we were getting the Pfizer line. We weren't getting, you know, reporting. We were getting what Pfizer wanted to be told.
Yeah, I'd say you are correct. I think you'd be able to find out what it costs to put a container through a port, for God's sake. I mean, you can get the price to send one from here to China. It doesn't break it down how much they pay to get it through the report, type of thing.
Well, if you had asked me at this time yesterday, I was in a convention with a ton of logistics companies, so I probably could have gotten you that answer.
Yeah, I'm sure they would know. But anyway, I was surprised last night during the, and I didn't watch word for word, but you know, it struck me on both of these guys, Kevin, is that the only time they really sounded like buffoons is when they were asked to defend the policies of the people they were running with. Trump's guy must have been asked four times by that Irish lady she kept sticking at him. How exactly are you going to deport the millions and millions of people you say are here illegally? He never wants to answer the question because there's no answer to that. I mean, right? There just isn't.
No, he did lead with the one thing that I would say you totally have to do, and that's if you commit a crime, you're deported.
I had no problem with that. But I'm saying,
I think that's easy. Where you go from there becomes a whole other conversation, and about starting with feasibility. But right off the bat, you have to say, if we arrest you, if you commit a crime, then you're going to be sent.
What about the people here who have four or five felonies? Can we send them with them?
I would be fine with that too, but I don't think we're going to be able to do that.
But I don't have a problem with what he said. It's what he didn't say. She kept saying, "How are you going to get rid of all these people? Your boss says he's going to deport them all. How are you going to do that?" Instead of saying, "That's a stupid thing for my boss to say," he
obviously can't say that though.
Right, I know. And the other dude had some trouble defending some of Harris's stuff. How are you going to give all this money to mortgage people and so forth? I'd say that the only time they both were tongue-tied is when they were asked to defend what their bosses were saying.
Yeah. But when it came to just, discussing policy, whether you agreed with them or not, they both were pretty fluent in the relevant policy issues that were involved in the discussion, and that was pretty interesting to see.
Way more fluent than either one of the people that are running ahead of them.
Yeah. Now, I sort of get why Trump isn't, because he kind of wings it on everything. I think he probably studies more than we give him credit for, but nevertheless, he's not a product of government. I really, really don't understand why Harris isn't more fluent in there. She served at all levels of politics, including a United States senator. And I just don't understand why she can't talk policy and get wacky with everybody.
I don't think she follows a line of people, and I'm going to say Bush, I'm going to say Obama, and I'm going to say her, and clearly I'm going to say Trump, where the details are beneath them. It's too much work. And I find it really scary. A lot of people don't. They say, you delegate. When the decision comes, you use your life, whatever, your life mojo to make the right call. And I just, that's not me, Kevin. You know that.
Yeah, and I listened yesterday or Monday, I can't remember which now, to the guys in charge of logistics for Mattel. One of his main points was, don't delegate the difficult stuff. Don't delegate that's where you have to get into the details. You can delegate the stuff that's going well, but the stuff that's really challenging, you better know the details, no matter what level of the organization you are, whether you're C-level or whether you're, first-line manager.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I think he's absolutely right about that.
I also think, the style that, my boss at Allied Van Lines, Bob Seeger, terrific handball player, by the way.
Really good singer, too.
I mean, how about that for a same name, huh? And he said, when you have people working for you, he says, you get 10 reports. He'd ask me to do, studies and reports and stuff. He loved me for doing all that stuff for him. And he said, the first couple times somebody does something for you and kind of randomly after that, you can't just take the conclusion. You got to read the whole report and add up all the columns just to make sure that the person giving it to you did the job right so you can trust them the next time. But every once in a while, you got to dig in. And he goes, that's why I want you doing stuff for me, because the stuff always adds up. I can take it. I can walk right into the boardroom. And if they say, how do you know that's right? I can say, what do you mean? Tom did it. And, you can't get that kind of trust unless you look at it yourself a couple times and make sure he's doing things the way you would do them. And not necessarily the same way, but a way in which it makes sense. He doesn't, like, forget pieces and things like that. You can't just, you know, and I've heard, I mean, that you know, the Trump story is he thinks that his lifetime, you know, whatever, street sense is going to carry him the whole way. No computer on his desk, you know, that those sorts of things. And I hope that's not totally true. But, you know, then you contrast him to the Winston Churchills of the world and the Bill Stevenson of the world that read every report that came across their desk that was like a Victorian novel every day. So, can you get caught up in that too much? Maybe.
That was always a criticism of Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, well, I would say that he
couldn't delegate anything. He had, you know, he had to go, you know, wade through everything in the details. And he was so caught up in that he didn't come out and see the big picture all the time.
I would say, Kevin, that if you and I somehow dropped into a senior government place for the first year or two, you and I would be Jimmy Carter, because everything that came to us, we'd say, "Wait a minute, who did this? This sucks." I have a feeling that we would find that the bureaucracy did not do things the way we wanted done, and we wouldn't believe anything anybody did. I just get that feeling.
I'm not sure. I'd be more inclined to do that than I normally am. But I'm like your boss, Bob Seger. You know, I'm the guy who says, "Yeah, I wanna have faith in you, but as soon as I do, I want to delegate because I want you to do the things I hate doing."
Well, without a doubt. I mean, isn't that
suggest? So I hire people who like doing the things I hate doing.
Baseball, and we also have two people we have to talk about today: Dikembe Mutombo and Pete Rose.
We could throw in Kris Kristofferson too.
Yeah. The Pete Rose was quite the character. I mean, I actually have a friend Pete Rose was in court at one time. And they were after him in a, I think it was an auto dealer or somebody like that. I'm not exactly sure. But they kept trying to get the person to turn on Pete Rose and say that he bet on his games. Said he was just a consummate gambler, where he would, like, buy a Mercedes when he was winning. Then he'd bring the Mercedes back 3 days later because he was losing. Then he'd come buy it back. And he was not a brilliant guy by any stretch. He had issues, but he was not an intelligent man. Got locked into this gambling. I don't know what there was a guy on Quora yesterday talking about his lifetime exemption. Now that he's not alive, he should be free to go in the Hall of Fame. Well, I never even thought of that, but I don't know if that's true or not. Whatever that is.
Well, if he shouldn't have been in when he was alive, he shouldn't be in when he's dead either.
Well, there are people in there that have gambled.
Well, I understand, but did his circumstance change just because he died? It did not. So either you're going to bless the circumstance because now you're all about gambling in your sport anyway, or nothing's changed.
Well,
it doesn't matter much to me one way or the other anyway.
It's a question of fairness. I mean, why should we let Tony La Russa in the Hall of Fame when people were shooting himself in the ass with steroids in his locker room, when those guys can't get in? And, oh, by the way, La Russa goes in because he was supposed to be a guy who knew every single detail about everything. All right, so, I mean, I don't know what that tells you. But it, you know what I'm saying?
It tells you that we like to arbitrarily apply standards.
Yeah. I'm just saying, you know, that's what we do.
It is what we do. Yeah. Unfortunately, it is what we do. Pete Rose, a terrific ball player. You've got a couple of interesting statistics on him. Interesting little nugget. there's this theater, the Lerner Theater in downtown Elkhart near me, and they'd been advertising for a couple of months about an upcoming event, an evening with Pete Rose, where I suppose he'd sit up on stage, tell stories, you know, take questions from the audience, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, anything for a buck, I suppose. And, you know, I kind of thought back and forth about, you know, whether I should hit up my buddy Joe and say, let's go see him, or if I think, yeah, Pete Rose is so full of crap, I don't know if I want to see him. But I would bet you he tells a pretty good story. Then, about 2 weeks ago, it was abruptly canceled, and it, with no explanation. So, it was so it wasn't a decision I had to make, but what was but now we know why. Obviously his health took a downturn, and he had to cancel the event.
Well, yeah, I would say that that's exactly correct. Some of the stuff about him, you know, will never, nobody will ever even think of this happening ever again. I mean, in a sense that the guy played 500 games at five different positions. And I think he was an all-star at five different positions. I mean, that's really something when you think about it.
Yeah, it's highly unusual. I mean, we think of somebody like a Robin Yount, who was really a terrific, an all-star caliber, Hall of Fame caliber shortstop, who moved out to center field and was a Hall of Fame caliber center fielder, and kind of think that's remarkable. This guy did it at five positions.
Yeah, and you have, we had the one guy in Houston. He was a catcher, and then he went to the outfield, right? Center fielder?
Oh, Biggio. Yeah.
I mean, some people, it has happened, but not very often. Like we said, the I think, Kevin, I read once that it has kind of moved from the straight gambling to all these allegations. Who are all these alligators? That, you know, he sold his bat from his 1,000th hit, you know, 25 times, those kinds of things. You know, I don't know if anybody can prove that or what the story is, but I read that once, and again, it was, you know, just somebody's article, but that he had sold memorabilia multiple times with the same memorabilia. You know, that he had turned...
Or at least claiming the same, you know, a different bat was the same thing that he sold before.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm at some point, I guess, if, you know, I don't know the legality or morality is, if you can point to, you know, 15 other people in the board, in the Hall of Fame that used to gamble on games, I don't know how you single one guy out.
He bet his biggest problem was that he bet on his own games.
Yeah.
When he was the manager, and you can't do that. Even if you say, well, yeah, but I bet my team to win, I didn't tank a game. You know what? That's going to affect, if you got enough money on the game, it's going to affect the decision making. Do you have a relief pitcher, a closer who really should not work today? But I got 10 grand riding on this. Okay. So much for that guy's arm. Let's just pitch him. You know, you can get into those kinds of decisions, and that's, you know, that's a big problem. You can't have managers doing that. Pete Rose was a terrific ball player, an incredible competitor, and very knowledgeable about the sport itself, the people who were playing, who his contemporaries were, what they were like. You know, I mean, he was a walking, talking scouting report on every single player in the major leagues, it seemed like. That was what he was good at. His personal life, a mess. His ethical life, a mess. And that's, you know, so, you know, that's kind of your Pete Rose story. Take the good with the bad.
Well, I think so too. And it's just kind of a shame. But, you know, when he was playing, I did, you know, hear stories about things. I said, you know, most of the time, you know, I love to hit in softball, you know, but if all of a sudden we're up, you know, 95-2, and it's a back inning, and I'm already 4-for-4, you know.
Playing the muffalettas?
Yeah, playing the muffs, and you're sitting there, and you go, you know, what? It's not like you would ever tank it at bat, but said he would, it didn't matter what the situation was, he wanted that next hit. It didn't matter if he was 5-for-5 and he already won it by 30. The next hit was just as important to him as the first one. When there were people on base and you were losing, which is, I'll just say it's kind of different, Kevin. It's probably not that it's wrong or anything. It's just, it wasn't like he was going for the stats or anything. Every single at bat was a massive challenge. He didn't care what it was.
It was how he competed. You walk on the field, you're competing until someone takes you off the field.
Yeah, you certainly see that's why in basketball, supposedly the guys who think they're the smartest bettors want to bet the second half, because some team's up 25, even if they're 15-point favorites, they're probably 6-point underdogs in the second half, right? Because you're going to play other people. Guys aren't going to try as hard. You already got the game won. It's really hard when you're up 30 to keep, to dive for a loose ball, isn't it? I mean, some people will, but it's harder to do that.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
What about Dikembe, though? Different story. Talk about a terrific guy, huh?
Different story. So there's a guy who went to Georgetown as an international student. Not going to play basketball. When do you want to study pre-med or something like that? Or engineering or whatever it was. It wasn't anything lightweight. Brilliant man, but also very gifted athletically. And John Thompson got a load of him and said, "Oh, this guy's. We need to talk." For a while, Thompson struggled with the idea of whether he should play him at the same time on the court with Alonzo Mourning. Until I forget who the coach was that said, "Don't be a dope. Yes, of course you play both of them at the same time."
Yeah, try and find somebody who has a team that can take care of both of those guys.
Yeah. So 8-time All-Star. I think 3 times led the NBA in block shots, a couple of times led the NBA in rebounding, 4 or 5 times Defensive Player of the Year, terrific basketball player. Smart guy, always seemed to, the commercials he did were fun. Never a big scorer in that he was probably about a 10 points a game guy, but a great defender, good teammate. He has 2 teams have retired his number, the Nuggets and the Hawks. So that'll tell you something there.
Didn't he speak like 7 languages?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he spoke many languages. I think some guys, I don't get too much into the personalities in sports. I'm interested in the way they compete, but I always figure there's never really a way you can know. It's almost impossible to know, what goes on behind that isn't the public persona. In his case, he really did seem like a good guy. Teammates loved him, and he did a lot of community work that I think was valuable as well.
Well, didn't he build a hospital somewhere?
May have, that I don't know.
I think he spent a real lot of dough doing stuff back in his native wherever he came from. I think he was pretty much a singular guy, really, and it's a shame. 58's young. Pretty good guys. Well, it's good young for anybody, but it's kind of a shame. Just what's your feel? I mean, now you've been at this seminar. Tell us about the lady from J.B. Hunt yesterday.
Yeah, so she was talking about a lot of things, and she had a good she was the afternoon keynote, she very casually several times talked about being in a recession. And I thought, well, that's interesting. that someone who's the CEO of a major transportation company would word it like that. Now, I did get a chance to chat with her afterwards, in the go for drinks section, and she did clarify that we're in a not a transportation. Logistics, not logistics either. I forget exactly what word she said, but it was basically into transportation industry is in a recession, and it's been that way for quite a while. I think that's, that was kind of interesting to hear, though, because in my mind, freight concession, uh, re- recession is what she said. In my mind, if you're in a freight recession, you're probably in a recession. So, because if you ain't shipping stuff, you know, now inventories, you know, how much inventory you have is going to cause a slowdown and all that. But, you know, this is not like a last month phenomenon. This is something that's been going on for a long time. And so I do think that was an interesting perspective to hear, because we talk about it all the time. That what are the numbers? You know, if you dig into the numbers, what are they telling you? And then if you talk to typical families as opposed to you know, the pundits in New York or Washington, what kind of story you're getting? How disconnected are they? Because they're fine. So I thought that was a little bit eyebrow raising. And she said, you know, when she did an interview with somebody and she used that term, and she said, you know, people started freaking out, like, what's she talking about? Said, yeah, because nobody on CNBC would ever tell you that.
Well, I don't, I'm just kind of, we've seen, I mean, we've heard, well, me and other people on the show rag continually about how difficult it is to do a, to try and figure out really whether you're on foot or horseback with the numbers these days because of the money being poured into the system. And because you screw up basically all your, everything you're dealing with. But instead of looking at our stuff and believing me, just take a look at what's happened in China in the last several days. Now, the country is absolutely destroyed by too much debt, correct? And now all of a sudden they come out and they say, we're going to we're going to take the stuff from we're going to allow these people to put out more debt, and we're going to put money into the system. Now, okay, we do that, and now all of a sudden the market's up 15-20%. And everybody's convinced that we created this, quote, wealth. And you have all the people here on CNBC talking about what an idiot you were for not investing in China 5 days ago like they told you to, or some stupid thing like that. Now, the... Why, you know, why all of a sudden does anybody really think for a second that you could create wealth by just printing more money? Now, you can create wealth for some people who have stuff that moves with that, but other people, just in general, you print money, you don't have another aircraft carrier, you don't have another bridge, you don't have another educated citizen, you don't have, there's no capital whatsoever you just made. But we have an entire population worldwide now, Kevin, that thinks just the opposite. You can give me money by throwing money in and having my stock go up. There's people in China that are giddy over this. What have they accomplished? I'm saying nothing. But can you get away with it once or twice, maybe? But now this has become the mantra everywhere. There must have been five people on CNBC saying, it's obvious the world is becoming dovish and currency flows and blah blah blah, and there's money entering the system, and all of a sudden everybody's going to go back to work, everybody's going to do this, everybody's going to do that. It doesn't work that way. But how does China today say, how could they possibly be in a quote recession? Because the dollars, how can we be in a recession? Because somebody just bought, you know, a yacht. The numbers are not there. Yet this lady's talking about, I'll ask you this, Kevin. In today's world, how do you define recession?
I think you define recession as, it ain't a recession until it takes the wealthiest people starting to feel pain, which means hardly ever.
Okay, but I mean, it is supposed to mean two successive quarters of negative GDP growth. In other words, instead of growing, you're contracting.
But it doesn't mean that anymore, because last time we had that, they said no, that's not a hard and fast rule.
But if you raise the price of everything 20%, how do you have negative growth? If you use the nominal numbers,
And how often do we hear, hey, the consumer hasn't stopped spending? Yes, the consumer has stopped spending. The volume of goods bought is down. It's down like 3% over the last 3 to 4 years. That's not the problem. But the dollar amount that consumers are spending is up. That's true. But they're buying less. They're buying fewer things because of it. Instead, they're starting to cut back on a lot of things.
Well, that's right.
You're starting to see some adjustments in that as well. So for instance, fast food places have priced themselves basically out of a lot of business, and so now they're starting to do. They're not doing dollar menus anymore, but everybody now has some kind of a special, set of special deals that better fit the budget. It's not the old dollar menu. It's not even the dollar and a half menu, but it's still. They've all come up with something new lately because they have to. People are being driven out of away from buying certain things. Anything that's discretionary has been taking a hit.
Well, everybody who's gotten their certainly their home insurance bill or their auto insurance bill, probably. Well, Kevin, mine is. Mine is so weird. Mine went down. State Farm did some weird thing. I mean, what State Farm?
My auto insurance has held steady. Homeowners up. Personal liability up a lot. I think it just depends on what's going on with the insurance pool.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The personal liability, my umbrella policy went up a bunch. And, my homeowners, my renters, went up, and because I have the other two there, the auto insurance went down. So.
I had that set down about a year ago with my State Farm agent. Yeah, we went through everything and sort of repackaged it all, and I did save some money. I will grant that.
I guess when you can't. When you start confusing people with the numbers, though, it's really hard. I mean, that's at the bottom line of this whole mess. When you talk about the politics, and you saw people debating last night, and you see the other two debating, I guess, soon at some point here. When you talk about the politics, it's basically somebody. Obviously, on a federal scale, you got all this. You got all these other issues with wars and stuff like that. But if you take politics as your basic, say a mayor's race or a county race where you are or something, there's two people, three people, four people, whatever it is, are essentially running for a job, and they're telling you that they can do the job, which is running the city, better than the next person, more efficiently, wherever. There's some policy in there, but really it's 90% management, right, or it ought to be. And there shouldn't be that much difference in a policy between one mayor and the next, although there is lately, which is really kind of sucks. But, pick a small town. You're going to have a police force, you're going to have a fire. The idea, can I do this better than the next guy where your taxes are going to be 90% of X or 110% of X where is today's stuff? You're really running along those. That's what you're trying to tell people. You're going to do a better job than the next guy, right? Same way when you're a CEO of a company. It's not quite the same, but I can make widgets where I can keep people happy, and oh by the way, I can make more money, so the investors make more money, and that's what I do. But all of a sudden, you have stuff like audits. You can't just say you made a bunch of dough if you didn't and give yourself a raise. You have to prove it to people. But now, when you all of a sudden, what if business? If you like they used to, if you could just tell anybody any number, you give any number you wanted. And so when you get into politics and all of a sudden you start lying with the numbers, they essentially are grading the people in office. If they can change the numbers, where are you? I think you're up bleep peep creek without a paddle. I mean, maybe that's
why they're so why they're so distant from the details. It gives them plausible deniability when they lie.
Yep, that probably a really good point, Kevin. I'm never supposed to tell you that, though, but that's probably a really good point. What do you mean? I get these numbers. That's what the people from... funny you should mention that. My guys at the Federal Reserve, how can I say this nicely? I can't. When they used to come to work, they used to go over to the series and have a drink once in a while, and I knew a lot of these guys. Well, now they don't work anymore. They're all at home. It's the craziest thing you ever saw. They don't work. Well, I mean, I'm not saying they're not doing anything at home, but the building's empty. There's nobody there. But be that as it may, I said to the one dude, I go, you know, you guys just had a policy meeting, and I said, what? These CPI numbers are ridiculous. You guys should know that. It's time you can't have a federal meeting at that level when all your governors come together and all they do is, the entire crux of the meeting is the people from the Bureau of Labor Statistics did a horseshit job. And you can't believe the numbers. That's never going to happen. Now, on one level, I guess I get it. On another level, you know, don't pee on my shoes and tell me it's raining. I mean, I don't know where the truth fits in there, do you?
It doesn't. You know, the truth is there to be shreds of somebody's argument, but only shreds. Let's jump back to the port for a minute.
Yeah.
The port strike. I think the easy part is coming to agreement on the compensation. Like that part's pretty straight up. They'll figure that out. But this discussion of automation and holding off on automation, does labor ever get to tell the company that they can't automate?
I think you get to have it in your union contract that if there's going to be training for people to be the people that run the stuff, that the union people get to participate in the training and be the new people.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't think I don't think you ever can say if we go out and buy a bigger dump truck where it carries the weight of two previous dump trucks that you have to have two drivers sitting in there.
Yep. Any more than you can you say here? You can't buy this new computer system that makes purchasing more efficient, so we won't need more. We won't need as many purchasing agents. Do you? I think it's kind of a bold position when they talk about the money and they try to make the union look bad for asking for a significant raise, and nobody really gets much into that automation argument. And you can see it. You can see it in Los Angeles. I sent you some videos. You can see it at things like Rotterdam, that has one of the most automated ports in the world, where all of these shipping containers are unloaded by unmanned devices, loaded onto drone transport vehicles that get them to where they're supposed to go. That's the kind of automation that is concerning them. And I just think that's inevitable. And if you want to keep your port non-competitive, a good way to do it is going to be to resist any of that automation.
Well, the one that I saw that you sent me, you had the guy going from this place to that place, essentially the driver coming in doing all the work. I think that I don't see that as being faster at all. I mean, all that guy's
There's different layers of it. So you have to look at the things the Chinese are building. You have to look at Rotterdam. You have to those are the ones that are kind of the end game now. The end game, as we know, the technology now, and that's not something that you just go install tomorrow. It's something that goes in step by step. But those are the one about Los Angeles is interesting because they are doing a lot more of those. Drone transports and unmanned stuff, and basically your controller is somebody who sits in a booth on top of it all, making sure everything runs, sort of like an air traffic controller or somebody like that. That becomes the job. If you've ever seen video of the Amazon warehouses with the robots that go pick up the shelves and cart them around and bring shelves to the pickers rather than pickers to the shelves. You know, it's that kind of technology where they're following tracks.
This stuff's been around.
They won't crash into each other. They have sensors, all that kind. All of that is pretty much commodity technology, and that's what they're resisting.
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, but then you can't be, you know, remember from somebody, a letter from somebody, I won't say Carl yesterday, that, you know, you read the thing, what are you supposed to do? Okay, massa, give me $2 an hour? Because it's this threat of, some automation, I think, ends up being worse for people. For even, you know, is even that efficient. I mean, you see those things we're riding around, the drone stuff? You see this, what do you think the cost of one of those things is? What do you think the maintenance is? Now, are you gonna at least the maintenance on this stuff, are you gonna try and say it's not union? I mean, there's a lot of shades of gray here.
That's not what the argument is. The argument right now is that you won't install any of this automation.
I find it very...
Yeah, if you want to say your automation has to be union work, then, you know, our union has dibs on that, put that in the contract. That's a negotiable item. But telling them they can't do it at all, it seems to be a bridge too far.
I heard the guy who was the head of the union yesterday, and he said, we all know automation's coming. The question is, are we going to be a part of it? He didn't say there wasn't going to be any. The same people that are controlling the news on the 50% are probably controlling the news on the guy's attitude instead of asking him. I mean, you know, the slant towards management is always dramatic in these things. You know, I think there's always going to be people working in these ports, Kevin. I mean, I bet there's a lot less people than used to be working in ports. I mean, those days, they used to take off the boxes, for God's sake. Well, there aren't boxes anymore.
They didn't have shipping containers, they were unloaded pallets.
God, what do we do without shipping containers? How did we all live?
Well, not just the shipping container, but standardization of it across the world is one of the biggest advances in logistics ever. You know, that's like a landmark type of thing. There's two sizes of shipping containers, and that's all in the world. And they fit on trucks, and they fit on trains, and they fit on cargo ships.
Stacked higher and higher.
Stacked higher and higher on the cargo ships, stacked too high typically on the train, and stacked on the back of a truck, yep.
Remember when they used to take the entire trailer and put it on the train, and I guess how much more efficient this is, huh?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Whenever this happens, though, and you see this constant slant, really, of everything, you know, I wanted your take on what's going on in the Middle East, just real briefly. I mean, not from a war. It comes down to, you know, in my opinion, when you start asking people to help you, and I don't have any problem really helping the, you know, Israelis if they're attacked. Doesn't that give you some sort of a say in, well, you know, wait a minute, you're counting on us. If Iran does this to you, you better get our approval before you go into Lebanon, because this isn't an open-ended checkbook. I don't know enough about the situation, but it seems kind of weird, Kevin, that we're not involved in, or maybe we are, and you can't be half in, right?
The president said he hasn't been talking to him.
Somebody is. I mean,
somebody is, but it ain't the president.
Well,
which is probably fine in this case, but very very strange, very unusual.
The politics.
When we talk about what should be delegated, it seems like that's not the kind of thing that should be delegated.
I just wonder, looking at, I've only been involved, Kevin, 2-3 times. When I say involved, I wasn't really involved, but a kid across the street went to Harvard, blew his parents away, right? This is a long time ago. And I read all the articles, and not one of them was accurate. This is just a regular news article. when Mayor Johnson was pinched for drunk driving or wherever he was, and they claim he was drinking over at the Ceres, and all of a sudden I could tell that one person had the story and every other, from Cranes or someplace, every other reporter just read that story and cheated on it and just plagiarized it and changed it just like it was a Latin paper, for God's sake, in high school. Every time I've been close to a story, the reporting on it has been horrendous. Totally inaccurate, totally ass-slap job. So when I look to this, how do we know who's... I mean, who's... The Israeli guys are telling us, look, we're going to go knock off this guy at Hezbollah, which I don't really have an issue with, because I'd rather have knocked the guy off than knock a bunch of people around him that are innocent off. But here's the retaliation. By the way, you guys got to help if this happens. Okay, well, we're willing to help like maybe once or twice, but how far do you plan on going with it? Is there some sort of plan? Does somebody have... Does the guy in Israel know how far we're willing to back him? Is there any limit, or should there be a limit? This is a pretty complicated situation, Kevin. I would hope somebody's got this dude's ear, and he better pay attention. Just saying. Or is that just me?
Well, no, it is. The big thing we do is we sell them arms. We sell them, sell them jets. We sell them arms. We sell, all kinds of stuff. So, what am I selling this to you to do? Is always the question. What are you going to do with it?
I think that from what I read, and again,
let's just take a simple example. If you were a gun shop owner and someone came in to buy a gun, and that person was intending to take the gun down to where he used to work and shoot up the place, would you sell it to him?
Some people would. I wouldn't.
Yeah, I would not. I mean, I think that's, that would be the ethical decision. If I know you're pissed off and you're going to go shoot him up, then I'm saying no. I'm not. Of course, I'm not selling you that. It's just a bigger version of that story. Is if you don't agree and you can't support what they're going to do, then are you going to sell them the stuff to do it? And so that's the relevant question, and that's a debatable thing. Some people will tell you no, you've been in that camp a lot where you think they go too far, and other people will say, why shouldn't they get to win? Somebody picked a fight. Why don't they get to finish the fight? I think, those are ends of the spectrum, and there's probably some other more nuanced articles in arguments in between. But yeah, of course you should have a say. Same thing with Ukraine. Of course we should have a say. By the way, did you see that thing? I think it was last week or so, where Zelensky and Governor Shapiro in Pennsylvania were at the bomb factory, and they were signing, they were autographing the bombs, they were signing their names on the bombs, like, here's a from me to you, Russians. Now, I could see Zelensky doing that, but boy, I don't think I want the governor of Pennsylvania doing that. That's sort of like saying I'm in this fight, it's if that's going to be shot at Russian people, potentially on Russian shore or Russian territory, and I'm putting my name on this? I don't think so.
It's not.
God, I hope it. I hope it's not a dud, and they find it. Don't find it in a field in Russia.
Yeah. No kidding.
Could you imagine?
Is the guy Ukrainian?
Shapiro? No.
I'm going to say he probably isn't.
No, he's. Whatever else he is, I know he happens to be Jewish, because I think that's. He was a strong contender for the VP nomination.
That's why I didn't get it. Yeah.
But they were afraid to have a Jewish VP because they piss off all of their, Michigan Muslims.
Isn't
Kamala married to a Jewish guy?
Yes, yeah, she is.
Okay,
that's why she can't overdo it. Can't overdo this, Russell.
Yeah. So I just didn't mean to throw that one in there.
No,
I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I know it is true.
It is noteworthy.
I'll tell you what. I know who. If she had a chance, Kevin, she might even ask you for a ride. Our girl Angelica would be happy to go out and sign one of those bombs after showing me
that's
pictures.
Different. Yeah. Yeah, but but that's a little different. She's not a public official in the United States.
Yeah.
She is a Ukrainian national.
Okay. And her, she showed me pictures of her school and the hospital she was born. There are rubble on the ground, so I don't think you'd get too much concern if she saw Bob dropped out of Russians. I'd say
no, not at all.
Yeah,
one other thing though, that when you talk about who the collateral damage is in the Middle East, I was watching a video of a house that got shelled. That looked like just a house in a neighborhood, and it got bombed. And then after the bomb exploded, count to 10, and then boom, and then another boom, and another boom, because they were making bombs in that house, and serially they were blowing up. That's sort of the dilemma that they have, the Israelis have, is this, everything that is used to wage war against them is embedded in the neighborhoods, which should be a war crime to do that, because it is really making people into targets. It's making people who are non-combatants into targets.
Well, it depends. It always depends, Kevin, on your point of view and how far back you want to go. I would never justify anybody doing anything, and someday at some point you got to just let it go and move forward. But I think there's an awful lot of people that feel that they got shoved out of their place on day one by the Israelis and have never forgiven them and never will. Now I think at some point,
so if those people are willing combatants in the war, then they are at risk. And all I'm saying is we do feel sorry for the folks who are collateral damage, who are not engaged, but the dilemma is that there are so many who appear not to be not engaged who actually are.
It comes down in a lot of ways is, who gets to define the rules of warfare, and the winners always seem to take that role on, right? I'm not justifying anything that happened on October 6th. I abhor violence of any kind, but if you think that everybody should come out and fight you with a tank, except for the fact that they don't have a tank. Now, if somebody starts to make a bomb in his garage, that's all he's got, I guess everybody else in the hood should come over and kill the guy and get rid of the stuff. So they're not. That's probably not going to happen either. It's a very tangled web. It really is. And I agree that at some point everybody's going to have to sit down and say, okay, here's where we are today, here's what we're going to do, and let's go forward and let bygones be bygones as best you can. It happens in every war, right? It just has never really happened there. It almost happened with Clinton and Arafat, and it didn't. It did happen a little bit with some of the it happened with Egypt and some of the other people, the unilateral stuff, but it never really got to the bottom line, or what are we going to do with all these people that are refugees, whatever the hell they are, in all these areas now that are horrible? Is there any way we can bring them back on the world stage? It's not just a Jewish problem. It's maybe a UN problem, maybe it's something. But we have those spots all over the world. How many places are people shooting each other at any given time, like 7 or 8? These are big issues, Kevin, and we forget them for a while, and we sort of think that somehow they're going away. They don't go away unless you address it, right? My mom in Chicago, we're ignoring the problem on the South and West Side. We've ignored it for what, 30 years? Is it getting any better? No. Someplace you got to actually do something, and we're pretty good at just forgetting stuff worldwide, neighborhood wise, city wide, country wide, aren't we?
Well. Yeah, there's, yet there are some grudges that don't get forgotten. And, clearly that is as much a religious war about infidels. It's the same reason that the United States is considered the great Satan and Israel is just the smaller Satan, the little Satan. you know, there is a religious aspect to it that some people buy into, and some people just use it for their personal preferences or for their advantage. But either way, you're dealing with that, and we don't deal with that in some other places. And I'm going to yield to, you know, yield to Russell. We're way into his time, so we should do that, and we can take this up a bit more on Friday if you want.
All right, bud.
But it really is, you know, it really is a it's a long-standing situation, long-standing hatred that just won't go away. Whereas, you know, imagine the hatred that we could have, that the Vietnamese could have towards us, as an example. And yet here we are. You know, they're big business trading partners because they realize the business, benefit of doing business with us. And you don't have to love us. You don't have to lose the grudge completely. But at some point, you say the smart thing to do is to work with these people. And they just refuse to do that in the Middle East.
And sometimes, unfortunately.
And that yeah. was what was behind all those bilateral agreements a few years ago. Those were the countries that were willing to say, yeah, I can live side by side with Israel, or I live in the neighborhood with Israel, and I can conduct trade with Israel, because that's an easier way to live.
Oh, I agree. All right, we'll talk Friday, bud. Drive safe.
All right.
He was down
about
near 50
50 miles from Louisville now. I was in the state of Russell, but not in the city of Russell.
Well, why don't you go in there and buy us a horse?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Well, see if there's a young old secretariat running around.
I have to be in Indianapolis in time to teach my class. Otherwise, I would definitely stop and buy you a horse.
You're liable to buy. You don't know anything about horses. The first one you see might be a good one. How do you know?
Yeah, I'll trade the car for the horse. How's that?
It's not a bad idea. Now, Russell probably knows a lot about horses. He's from down there.
Yeah, I used to ride a horse to school.
Really?
Oh yeah, we used to ride a little buggy to school. So,
what are
I'm
the
that
horse,
old?
What are the horses?
I'm that old, and I grew up in that rural of a part of Tennessee. Yes, I rode a horse to school every day.
What did the horse do all day while you were in school?
sat out there and looked sad, waiting for me to come pet him on the nose and say, "Let's head home."
Oh God!
I know. I'm pretty good at making stuff up before aren't I?
Well, I told you that one of my buddies in. He's 92 or something in Portage.
Mm-hmm.
The guy is the cabin that he was born in and grew up in is now mm-hmm. in a Kentucky state park as a artifact of something. It actually was.
It was that rural and.
Get a load of this. Yeah. The particular house was actually. Built by one of the original Hatfields of the Hatfield and McCoy stuff.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
the Hatfields and the McCoys.
It looked just like the house in the original Beverly Hillbillies, Jed Clampett, with the water outside and all the other stuff looked just like it. He said they had like seven people in there.
You know who I would send to buy a racehorse for myself for me and my family is my better half.
Really.
Oh yeah, back in the day when her parents would dump her off with her grandparents, her grandfather would take her to Maywood.
Oh,
she is an expert at betting. She can't do 2 + 2, but she is an expert at betting the ponies.
I used to pick up all the tickets and check them to see if somebody dropped a winner.
There was a guy at the dog track near where I grew up that would clear between 20 and 50 bucks a night doing that.
Really.
Yep, he'd just walk around and pick up everyone off the ground.
Oh, God.
That's a good job.
My question to you, Professor.
Yes, sir. And next week we've got a college student coming on. She claims to have lost her voice. I think she's nervous. And I told her that you're a big old teddy bear not to worry about.
Oh, yeah. Hey, when are we starting the open class thing?
Well, I might try to do that next week. I got to be down there for one. I'm not there today.
All right,
I'm really only there... full time in the spring.
You do realize that when we start that, every single person here wants to be a guest.
Oh, I know. And the students are terrified.
Why?
They're like, they want to do what? I gotta make them do that. And the president of the finance club is the one that's really pushing it. So I said, well, if you're pushing it and you want everybody to participate, you need to go on the first one. And apparently she lost her voice.
Well, you know, once you get rolling, it's okay.
That's what I told her. That's exactly what I told her. I was like, we're nice. I said, yeah, my high school age daughters have been on, and it went very well. And we're not just going to throw you out there to the wolves.
By the way, we need a meteorological daughter to explain how this hurricane, how the thing got so wide. How the difference, why some of them are huge that aren't as intense compared to other ones. Is it atmospheric stuff that causes some to expand? I mean, some of the most intense ones were actually pretty narrow. They only, as much as they kicked ass in a place, it was only in a place. This thing destroyed by rain.
This thing was wide. I lived in Atlanta for 5 years, and I sat there in my apartment and watched a couple blow through. And this thing was incredible compared to the ones that I lived through.
Well, the give us a little bit of, I've been trying to here, but you're the professor, and some of the stuff we've talked about on the show, and I think you agree with a lot of it, is I have a feeling that the first day you get into class, somewhere along the line you say, you can't create wealth. You can create money, but you can't create wealth in terms of aircraft carriers, bridges, educated students, whatever the capital is, human and otherwise, of a country. You can't print it. You have to make it, or you have to do something to get it. Contrast that with what's happened in the last week in China. Now, I know you might have had a position you didn't so much like over there, but...
Yeah, it has not been pleasant.
but all of a sudden, if you listen, you know, I had the volume up yesterday because we had so much stuff going on with the war and stuff. I don't usually put the volume up, but I did. There had to be, you know, 15 swinging idiots, one after another, talking about how this is the incredible solution in China, and how the rest of the world is now on board with this dovish, you know, central bank stuff, and we're all going to pour money in, and we're all going to be wealthy, and we're all going to be happy ever after. And nothing could be kind of further from the truth in my mind, but how do I have that debate where everybody in China thinks they're fat and happy? If you have stock now, they were talking about how much, one guy said how many hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth was created.
Well, wait until everybody tries to sell at the same time. It'll dissipate pretty quickly. But we talked about this a week ago, and I felt like it would be something that would work itself out quicker than it did. But it's really, you know, just a matter of making money much easier. But do they really have much to spend it on? Are they secure enough in how much they're making that you're willing to take a loan out? And if you've already got a loan on a place that's not even being built, how does a change in interest rates help you and change in liquidity and everything else? This is kind of like, you often talk about how Powell and those guys are fixated on making sure that the stock market's all right, and the stock market's not the economy. You know, when either of the political parties talk about how great the stock market has done when they've been in charge, that really there's a big disconnect there. You know, does who came before Trump? Trump took over from Obama. God, that's been so long. But if you recall, right after Trump got elected, small cap stocks rallied like 20% in a 10-week period. And then they basically underperformed for the 4 years that he was president. So do you say that small caps love him or hate him?
Well,
there's a huge disconnect between what's actually going on in the economy, and I think that's still going on over in China, because there's just not a whole lot that's going on in their economy.
Well, we've been...
So this is just financial engineering stuff. Much like the Fed cutting rates, because, you know, if they hit... We had that minor sell-off back in early August, and somebody was on CNBC talking about cutting 50 basis points. Emergency cut.
Yeah,
that was your... You gotta cut right now. Because stock prices are lower?
That was your buddy.
Which one of my buddies? You say everybody's my buddy, and I don't know anybody. I sit around with dogs all day.
It was your buddy. Who's the wheezy little guy who's the...
Neeson?
No, the economist. The economist.
The guy on CNBC.
Yeah, well, the guy from Wharton. What the hell's his name? The little guy with the glasses.
Oh, Siegel.
That was him.
That's just... That's why, you know what, I'm going to be shameless here. There's another professor and myself that are thinking about starting a podcast where we talk about the difference between the academic world and the real world on a weekly basis with things that are going on.
Can I come in?
Because you can come on. Of course you can come on. You have to turn on the camera, though.
Means I got to comb my hair?
I know you like being anonymous and all, so you don't like being stopped on the street. But, you can come on. Talk about what we're going to talk about. We're still working it up. But I you shouldn't take my financial advice. I'm a college professor. I have insights into the market and stuff, but I'm not.
You have more insights than most. Not many college professors have written a book.
I wasn't a college professor my whole life. I was on the buy side for 20 years. So, and on the sell side for about 5. So I do have experience, you know, real world experience.
How can that be? I thought you were like 32 years old.
I wish I felt like that's how long my career is.
Wow.
I guess I am 32.
What you just said, you may think you were just, you know, blithering along there, but you weren't. You hit me with a really huge question. Mm-hmm. That's what I love dealing with you guys is because I don't even have to prepare anything. Because all I have to do is listen to you guys talk for 10 minutes, and it leads me to a great question.
And the great question is?
We were talking earlier today and yesterday about who essentially controls the narrative, meaning the press, the policies, the whatever. If you read about the DAX strike, all you see is these greedy bastards are getting at a 50% raise hurled at them, and they said no. Nothing to do with how long the contract is, nothing to do with, by the way, what kind of raise did they get in their last contract? What's their total raise going to be over the 12 years, and did it come anywhere near close to keeping up with inflation? Or maybe even, you know, not their inflation, but our inflation. I mean, none of that. You don't get any of that stuff. But my question to you is you know, you're not that old, but if you were to go back 30, 40 years and you would find somebody that had a lot of dough, okay?
Mm-hmm.
How's that for a lot of scratch from the south side? I'm going to say this is my opinion. Virtually all that money was, quote, earned. When I say earned, somebody started a business. Somebody bought 2 gas stations. They were successes. They were neighborhoods. People didn't think they were going to move, and all of a sudden they did. And you know, there was something kind of entrepreneurial that created maybe some jobs, maybe not. But there was, or somebody went to work for a firm that, you know, he had a metal, you know, type of chemical thing where he had a process that was his, and he got paid, you know, 100 grand a year, and everybody else was making 20. And that essentially people who had money, there was always somebody in the Lucky Sperm Club that invested it and inherited it. But basically, I think people earned it because everybody came back from the war, and some people were luckier or worked harder or whatever. Now I'm going to say the wealth, the people who are coming out of it, I just you know, with some money come into the firm, I've been getting a lot of clients lately, which is good because I think if something bad happens, I'll have them protected, and we're still participating in the good stuff, so we're actually doing really good. Shameless plug, but anyway, money came in, and these are people who had a 401k, had something, and were in the market, and they've got 1.5 million, 1.7 million. They never made that dough. I mean, you know, it wasn't like they were a plumber and made $40 an hour and lived on 10 and put the 30 in the bank for 40 years. Nope, nobody's doing that anymore. In other words, the wealth now is either the big wealth is inherited. I'm not saying it certainly counts. And by the way, some people may have had an extra house or two, okay, which means they invested it and maybe did the sweat equity to fix the place up. But I mean, basically, if you bought a house 20 years ago for 100 grand, it's now worth 800. I mean, that's, you made more money on investments than you did by working in the last 10 or 15 years, which you can't, if you're a government, ignore that. and say, I don't mean it. I mean, Jerome Powell, as much as you and I say, the stock market's not the economy, in his world, the power is in the stock market. That's where the wealth is. So the politics of it,
yeah.
You and I are going to say, you shouldn't act that way. But guess what? The people who have this, quote, wealth bubble or wealth non-bubble, if he doesn't act that way, they're more powerful than the schlump making $100 a week, by far, in terms of controlling the news and controlling the Washington. I mean, if he were to say tomorrow, you know what, I'm going to work on this wealth bubble, I think 80% of the people in the country can't afford their stuff, so we're going to drop the money supply by 20%, and we're going to the 40% inflation that we've told you is 20 is really 40, and we're going to cut that out of there in the next 3 years. And by the way, if the market drops 40%, it shouldn't be this high anyway. Screw you. How do you suppose that speech lands, like a fart in church?
Well, and the real issue there is, and I'm going to loop it around to the classroom. The real issue there is you're talking about, you know, some nice nominal returns versus real returns. And the real returns would be okay for some people if you're making that adjustment where life hopefully becomes a bit more affordable.
But you know? I mean, but the people
and
who...
I think some of that, well, I don't think... I think there was some of that in Japan where, you know, the prices stayed exactly the same forever and they managed the best that they can. And, you know, we often talk about how their financial market seemed to have been in disarray for a very, very long time. But I do think, yeah, I'm not a social scientist or anything, but it seems to me that they have a pretty decent functioning society over there. They're not. Let's put it this way: if they're not happy with an election or something like that, they're not tearing up their shopping district.
No, but they're making the decision to not have any kids. What does that tell you about the future?
The decision to not make kids, I think there's a lot more to it than just financial. I mean, I don't think the financial part helps. But when I say the financial part helps, I don't think if you look at your day-to-day expenses, you're probably better off getting a dog than getting a kid because dogs aren't nearly as expensive. People should consider adopting this French bulldog right here. But there's more to it than that. We have part of it's technology. You got to be a freaking idiot to get pregnant by accident, especially as an adult. In this day and age, unless you're in, and you know where is the population still growing tremendously? It's in part of the, you know, it's in Africa, in places that are very impoverished.
I never could really understand that. See people that are, they weigh about 80 pounds. They can't. Don't know enough to eat. Everybody's sick. There's flies all over everybody, and yet everybody's holding the baby. You wonder how the hell the human, whatever it is.
What I'm going to say is somebody else's words from somebody that studied this at an Ivy League school. Because I asked this question, and this is from like 25 or 30 years ago. And the response that I just talked about the birth rates and the impoverished, blah, blah, blah. We volunteered in an inner city school in Atlanta together. And she went to Harvard. I don't know what she does now. But we were just talking about, you know, what is it with you know, what you just described? And she said, these are her words. I'm hedging myself big time here. She said, basically, they got nothing else to do but have sex.
Well, maybe, but my
if you're out in the middle of, she was equating this to the lower income areas of Atlanta, but it stretched. But then she actually brought up different parts of the world as well. About that's just what that's just in a nutshell. That's what it comes down to. Nothing else to do.
Well, I'm going to say that the people who are running this country are much closer to the people who hold wealth than the people who are schlumping through this week's paycheck.
Oh gosh, yeah. Absolutely.
And that's kind of
and I don't think a whole, yeah, one of the ways that candidates do try to make themselves more attractive is they talk about, you know, what you know, they talk about their background. Hell, if I was going to run for office, I'd jerk out all these sob stories about, and I'm, this is actually truth. My dad got fired on December 23rd.
Really?
This is stuff I kind of dug out after he passed away, and I started going through paperwork and stuff. And he really did get kind of screwed over. But yeah, he got fired. Yeah, when I was 8 years old, and family declared bankruptcy, took a step down in everything that we did. I would draw on all of that because the way I look now, people are going to think that I can't really relate to the average person. But I feel like I have enough of a background that I can. We talked about this is why I like to teach at the Indianapolis campus for Kelly, because you've got so many first-generation college students, et cetera, that are not, you know, not part of the class that can call up a senator, and your dad can call up a senator and get you an internship or something like that. So, you know, the disconnected 80%. How's that?
I think we're more disconnected than maybe we ever were.
I think there's a divide between the two, and now I'm really luckily I can't be taken out of context. But you know, you and I have kind of we've worked our way up and done well professionally to where we're closer to the divide that it's the who you know divide. So you know, we do have people. Yeah, you know, my daughter's doing very well in D.C., et cetera. She's gotten internships, et cetera, completely on her own. If Maggie were unable to get an internship and came home for the summer, she'd be working the board for you.
Well, there you go.
And that's just an example of, you know, the who you know.
Well,
you know, or she'd be on here an hour. I really want to get her to be on here an hour a week with you, without me. She keeps complaining about class schedules.
People can't stand a lot of people. Look at how it's driven your regular workers. How many regular workers are anti-union? I mean,
uh-huh.
And I'm not about to defend some of the bureaucracy that the unions ended up being. And where that sort of went, I'm not about to lob perfection at them, but the middle class that is now non-existent or pretty much non-existent doesn't put two and two together that maybe not on purpose, but the union presence in Washington really was the middle class presence in terms of agenda. I'm not saying that the unions ever thought about it that way or really mm-hmm. thought they were arguing for the middle class in general, but the agenda was fairly similar, right? I think. And right now, if you were to say the people who open up, you know, the regular schlumps of the world, like us, who exactly is our voice in Washington? Name me somebody. We don't have one, man.
If you and I tried to start, you know, a regular Joe pack,
don't say that. Don't say that. Let me warn you. Don't say that.
What? Well, but let's just say.
There's a reason why I'm going to tell you not to say it, because I said that once.
Uh-huh.
It got going. Oh no! It didn't get going. I got uh-huh. nothing but bad vibes. I said something about if we really want to do something,
mm-hmm.
200 of the listeners should send in $100, and we should have the Stocks and Jacks regular guy lobby group. And yeah. I got email after email. Maddie Weber was still here. What the hell are you talking about, Chief? That sucks. Why should I have to pony up $100? Those guys should just know what I want. And I'm going, that's an interesting position.
What I was going to say I was not saying we should do that, but if we were going to do that and start representing, you know, regular guy stuff, you know, up in D.C., the packs that are already in place, and probably the press, because you know you and I are old white guys, so we're automatically evil. We would get so beaten down so quickly, and remember Howard Schultz from that's his name, the CEO of Starbucks. He decided he wanted to run for president when, God, can you imagine how different things might be if he had won instead of Biden? But he was thinking about running, and you know the loud crowd. I'm trying to come up with a new name for different groups of people. But you know we're the silent majority, the very loud, unusual minority. They were showing up at his campaign events and just shouting him down and talking about how all he was going to do is split the vote and help Trump get reelected, and just how evil he was for the billions he made, even though I think at one time Starbucks might have been the biggest provider of healthcare in America. That's an exaggeration, but they really, you know, the reason people would go work there when they couldn't find a professional job out of college was because they gave them all the benefits.
In today's world,
so it was a decent place to work.
If we were going to do that, Russell,
but we would get shout down with our pack like he did when he was trying to run for president.
You never get shouted down with a pack, because if you have money in your pocket, they'll listen to you.
And you're talking about the government officials. I'm talking about the other packs in the press.
Oh yeah, but I'm saying
don't like what we're doing.
If Senator Durbin, now what you need to do on that, I've thought a lot about this. God, why would I even do such a thing? But we would have to look at today's world, and look at, God, this is not in today's world, but read 75, 80 years ago. Make that 90 years ago. Two people made incredible use of the new technology of today. And those two people were Franklin Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
They didn't go through the quote press. They did a Saturday thing every day, every week. I don't know when Hitler did his. I mean, I could care less. But the fact is,
he did it whenever he felt like it, and they played it on loudspeakers where everybody
it was on radio.
Not everybody had a radio. Well, you know what, I say that, Goebbels bought everybody in Germany a radio.
Yeah,
they gave them all radios.
To people directly. If we were ever going to do something like this, I mean, it wouldn't be us. If we were going to help somebody else do it, the first thing I would do is say, okay, we're going to buy a column in the Tribune every Sunday. And we're going to take an issue, and we're going to talk about the issue in a common sense way of dealing with it. This is what our group is going to do. And oh, by the way, we're going to be on. We're going to buy time. We're going to be on every Saturday morning for an hour, and we're going to talk about 1 week it'll be veterans, 1 week it'll be this. We're going to gain a media following. That the media, one of the things that Trump became famous for is he was on TV. You're fired.
Yeah,
you have to become known as somebody who, whatever. I mean, he came across as being, you know, the good exec, I guess, or the good business guy, whatever. But I mean, we would have to make our own stuff before we said we were going to do anything, because you can't just say you're running. You're right; they're going to be all over you. I mean, look at the people. Yeah. Look at the decent people, in my opinion, in the Republican Party that wanted to run for president. Well, the Trumpers, the 20% that, you know, love the guy, they were, instead of having an honest sort of thing, oh no, you're going to take a vote away from Trump. You have no right to do that.
I'll tell you, Nick, I think Nikki Haley would be eating Kamala's lunch.
Nikki Haley's a bright lady. I mean,
I hadn't even thought about that I would just love to see those two debate.
But you've got 15% of the people that are on the extreme ends that are controlling this country.
Yeah.
That's not right, in my opinion. No. And yet it's happened. So you ask yourself, how exactly do I get my message through the press? And my answer is, I don't go through the press. I go by myself or go with my group.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to ask, you know, it's funny, my back when we were, you know, when John and I were on the score, this is a, all sales, you know, politics and sales are pretty close, right? I would have people come in to the office and I talk to them about our protected program. This is, you know, back when markets used to go down a lot, as well as up. And, you know, we were money manager of the year in 97, having a protected program because everybody else got clobbered and we didn't. I mean, 2007. And but anyway, having said that, shameless plug, guys would come in and I'd explain the whole thing to them and they'd come to a seminar and they'd say, well, I went home and talked to my wife and she's not all into it. So my cousin, who's a terrific guy, and he's a good salesman, he's a great football player, by the way, he says, Tom, what are you doing? He goes, hey, you got all these degrees, and you know nothing. I go, well, that's an interesting prelude to the conversation. He says, don't ever let anybody sell your stuff. You sell it. Tell the guy to bring his wife with him. Have coffee, have some rolls. You know what? Once I did that, I never lost a sale. He goes, don't ever expect... Right now, if you and I wanted to have our political group, and I'm not saying nobody wants to run some, if we want to get our message across to Durbin and all these other people, we need some money, but we also have to say, we have to sell our own stuff. You don't do an interview on 60 Minutes where they carve the thing up and make you look like an ass. You say, if I'm going on, I'm going on live, and I'm going on for 5 minutes, and the whole thing gets on there. You don't let them edit your stuff, right?
Right, right.
I mean,
and I think I've told you that I don't really watch the outside the business press. I don't watch the news that much. And my wife had CNN on a few weeks ago, and Trump was getting ready to speak. CNN will not show Trump speaking live.
Really?
Yeah, because they don't want to help, and they'll even say, we don't want to help him spread disinformation. So we will. We're going to cut away here, and we'll come back to President Trump and discuss his remarks when he's done.
But you know, I don't agree to this with me on this, but because I don't want you getting in trouble. But it is amazing how the playbook doesn't change. I won't say for dictators or people who want power. When you try and sway people's votes, this whole thing with the, you know, people coming across the border, you and I believe, and please don't say anything because I don't want to, anybody saying you're
Oh,
agree.
Don't worry about it.
You and I know that how this has been handled. We can go back to the problems in Venezuela. We can create this great choreography of this whole mess, and. Fact is, there's people here, more people here than probably anybody would want. Okay, let's say that's the deal. Yet, there's all kinds of problems in this country that have been here for a while, for the middle class and for the lower class, and I'm going to say it's been a 25, 30-year progression, right? And we've got governmental problems. Our deficits have been there absolutely since, you know, for a while, and surely since Bush invaded a country and put the war on a credit card, we've been fighting deficits ever since. Worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been a 30-year phenomenon. So people have gone downhill in terms of their economic, what they think they can do in life. Can somebody getting out of college buy a business? Well, not exactly if you owe $250 in your student loan. Not exactly if this happens. By the way, the cars are so expensive. By the way, the repairs on a car are so expensive. You're never going to own a new car. You're never going to own a house. You get over it. These things happen. Now, most people don't look in the mirror and say it's my fault, and maybe it isn't even your fault. But what ends up happening is if you get a demagogue, you know, whatever. I know there's parts about Trump I like too. What you do and what dictators around the world have already done, you look all these people in the face and say, it's not your fault, it's these damn immigrants. If they weren't here, we'd have nothing but money for you, your world would be better. And yet, immigration now is, out of all of our problems, I'd put it at 5% of the total. In some areas better, some areas never even saw somebody. I'd say it's 5% of the total. The other 95, we've done to ourselves. But that message doesn't sell, does it? By the way, you screwed up.
You don't have somebody that you can point the finger at.
You're not going to say how many votes would we get if we walked in front of a whole group of people and say, you know, the problem we have is all of us. You have a government that you voted for the last 40 years that has, on average, spent 20% more than they took in. You should have been paying 20% more taxes if you elected those people and you never did. Talk about a stink bomb in the behind the altar, for God's sake. But it's the truth, right?
Sort of the truth. You don't have any choice.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But yeah, we do.
There's no freaking... We got no choice.
Well,
and this is how, you live in a... Let's say you live in Russia. And, you're basically... What you are fed what they tell you, and that's all you really know about your worldview, which to us would seem kind of silly with some of the things that they say, but you know they describe our system in a way that you're describing it, and talk about how you know it doesn't, regular people are completely left out of the system here as well. If you're not rich, you're completely screwed here. If you're not rich, you're completely screwed over in Russia as well. So, you know, which one might be better, which one might be worse for you as an individual. But they depict us as, yeah, they've got elections, but they really only have two choices. And both choices are backed by all the same corporations. So, you know, is there really free choice in the United States? Like they say, we don't have choice here in Russia.
We still have, on a local level.
If you describe our system... not how it was laid out to be in the Constitution, but how it actually is now, it can come across as we don't have as many freedoms and we're not really as much of a say as we think we do. There's a study out there that talks about if you really want to make a difference, you don't even worry about voting. Donate money.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, it's the money. It's just kind of sad. But
if you want to
don't even worry about voting. You know, just donate $1 million to something that you think that's the thing that you're into, and they actually can show how that money is translated into votes for your topic.
I mean, let's say, for instance, and this is, I'm not making any kind of a call here. Matter of fact, I probably would make a call the other way. But if Trump wins, it's somewhat of an unusual situation in the sense that he's really a lame duck on day one.
Yeah, and I actually consider that a positive.
Well, okay, but what I'm saying is if we wanted to do something on the Republican side, now, you know, I'm in the middle, so I don't really want to give money to any one of these people, but if we were going to do something on the Republican side, we would immediately, year and a half into his term, we would look around for who possibly could be next.
Yep.
And if we found somebody...
You start backing your guy.
If we found somebody we liked, say it's Nikki Haley, whatever, just pick a name out. I don't know if she's going to run again, I have no idea. I don't really know the lady that much, but say it's Nikki Haley. Immediately, we're going to have a coffee in Hinsdale or wherever you're at.
No. We would drive about 3 hours west and do it in Iowa.
In terms of support, we would do one at your place. We'd do one at my place. We'd have 10 people come by, $500 a throw. Nikki Haley comes over for a cup of coffee, blah, blah, blah. And as time goes by, it gets to be 50 people, and it's $1,000, and we have this in a little banquet hall, and we pay for the chow and the booze, and we send the one check with our name on it, but if we like her, but maybe it's somebody else. If we find somebody we think should be the person, that's when you have influence. You don't have any influence walking down. In 3 weeks, I got no influence. I walk down, I don't like either person. I'm going to vote for somebody else, even a Libertarian's a goofball all this time. But I don't have any influence on the state senator who's running unopposed. The state people aren't even running. But Mike Quigley's unopposed, I think. We have neither senator running. What am I going down the block for? It's like a Russian election.
Yeah.
But I mean, if we wanted to do something, we got to start right away. Now, if she wins, unless she really screws up, she's probably there for 8 years. I'm not going to start playing it for 8 years from now. I mean, 8 years is a long time. But 4 years, maybe on the Republican side or even on the Democratic side. Somebody, two new people have to run in 4 years if he wins, right?
Yeah.
So if we find somebody who we think is better than the rest, somewhat honest, somewhat straightforward, whatever, we got to start backing him right away.
Wouldn't it be funny if Robert F. Kennedy ends up, you know, let's say Trump gets elected, lots of hypotheticals here. And the reason that I, here's the reason I would prefer to see Trump elected over Kamala. And it has to do with my big topic. It has to do with what I think our big topic is, which is just how freaking, you know, overspending and how over, just how large our federal government is now. And one of the things that Trump and one of I think it's why RFK is teamed up with him now, is they want to, you know, they just want to cut the federal dole.
Except Trump didn't do that when he was in it.
And if they can do it, you know, and that's why I like the idea of Trump as a lame duck from day one. He could go in there, hopefully, and streamline a bunch of what is being done in the federal government, cut costs across the board, and it will be painful, but in a painful way, maybe balance some things for
the idea of here's the flaw in that argument for the people on the right, which I know you're, you know, a conservative guy. The flaw in that argument, that's what the conservative side is supposed to do, right? That's their shtick, is smaller government, all those kinds of things. The only problem is your guy, and I'm not saying that you're Trump's, was already there once and didn't do anything like that.
Yeah, that's because he did. You can be different in your second 4 years than your first.
Well, I'm saying he never.
Your first, you're worried about getting reelected.
But he has. And he has. Okay, but am I saying on a personal level? And you know, like I said, I was on the board of the CBO. If ever you wanted to make some progress with a policy, with a rule change, whatever it is, you need to have the personality to get people on your side, or else you're just one big mouth or one vote.
That's where RFK comes into.
But that's where Trump showed no ability of that.
Doesn't have it. That's why I like those two teamed up like that. I like that, you know, Kennedy's they always talk about his focus being, you know, on the FDA, on how bad our food for us. How bad the food is for us, a bunch of other things, but smaller government is one of the big things, and smaller that he's into, which is really funny because, you know, he comes from a lifelong Democrat family, and I think it actually says something when you got a Kennedy saying our government's too big.
Well, but Russell,
I really do feel like Trump should be campaigning on he's going to be our Secretary of Efficiency or something like that.
Let me ask you this. As you know, the reason why I love doing the show so much is I get to argue with people that I agree with, because I like to take the other side just to draw more knowledge out of them. If I could ask you, if you and I landed there and we made the federal government, let's say we could, I don't even think Trump thinks he can fire people, but he's not on TV anymore. I'm not so sure that if the budgets are there, and you know, I don't know how quickly you can get people out of the consumer something thing, the Elizabeth Warren thing that has 12,000 people in whatever they have. I don't know how you can't just fire people if they have the. I don't think you have that power. I don't know. I mean, it's probably more of a Lou question or something, a law question.
Well, and that's why, you know, you hear about the Project 2025 stuff.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying.
Okay, but no, this has to do with employment. This has to do with federal employees. One of the things that they wanted to do in that plan, and it's not a Trump plan, but he's been tied to it. One of the things in that plan is to make more federal employees political appointees, and when you're a political appointee, you can be fired.
All right, it's known as the
argument is, well, they're just going to put a whole bunch of their own people in there, and it's known as, it'll be horrible.
What's the Chicago term for that?
What's the Chicago term for that?
It's a patronage system.
Patron. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, but just in terms of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the issues, and Trump, to his credit, George Bush, I don't think he ever wanted to do anything anyway. Talk about the zero presidency, although he did invade a few people. His presidency was taken over by 9/11.
Yeah, it was. He was.
And Trump, I'm no Trump fan, but his stuff got taken over by COVID. But let me ask you just in terms of numbers, because you're a numbers dude, you professor kind of guys. If you and I were to land there and say we really had this kind of momentum and we shaved 25% of the people out of government and made it quite a bit more efficient, what do you think we just saved in the budget? I'm going to say less than 5%.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I have no idea what federal salaries are relative to everything else.
But some huge percentage of the money in the government that goes out goes to people, either by checks or by medical bills or by pension plans, by Social Security.
A good portion of it does. My understanding is what Iran did to Israel cost them $300 million. So I think a lot of our money goes into weapons as well.
I get that. I mean, what I'm saying is there's this idea when you're talking about, you know, $32 trillion, firing Harry and Jane, talk about a peeing in the ocean, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I'm saying is how do we go about, I mean, the Simpson-Bowles thing, and Obama saw that and he was horrified, right?
Yeah.
How the hell are you going to make that work? What did the one guy say? God, it's a horrible South Side term. What did the old hatchet face guy say? If we haven't pissed you off, we either forgot about you or you didn't read it. what a great line.
That's freaking awesome.
But it's there, but what do you gain by it? I mean, if you're going to, and we have a population that every person, I believe, knows something that I don't know. So there's no such thing as a stupid person. But collectively, we can be really dumb. And when you get your Social Security thing last year, I know people who have, and this CPI number that I always I always rag about, and everybody says I'm just a knucklehead by doing it. In your thing, so I read one of these, your Social Security went up, I think, last year to 2.8%, accounting for inflation. Yet the doctor's part of Medicare that you pay was up like 4.5% or 5%. So,
well, that's not right.
They're telling you in the same letter. Well, by the way, the way we're counting it over here is 2 point something, and the way we're counting it over here is 4.5. How does an entire country of people read that and not go, God, this sucks? I mean, what is with these idiots?
You look at it and you see a couple of small numbers, but then and like you said, you know, we're numbers people. What happens when you? And I'm going to make the numbers really easy here. What happens when you have one thing growing at 3% and the other one growing at 4% after about 10 years?
Big difference.
Yeah, that's an understatement. That compounding. I should use that. I got to use that example at some point.
If you know somebody older, I bet they kept a letter. I
know what you're talking about. You can actually log into your account and get it all and see your annual little letter online. So I could go get mine right now if I wanted to.
Well, but I mean, you're not on Medicare, are you?
No, I'm not on Medicare. Yeah. But okay.
But I'm saying that's for those who don't know what the hell I'm talking about. If you're on Medicare, the hospital part is, quote, I'll use the term free to you. It's included just by being an over 65 American, right? If you want the doctor's part, you have to contribute. And the contribution essentially comes out of your Social Security thing. So they're not counting on you to send you the bill and you send them the check back. They just take it, right?
That's one way to make sure you get paid.
Right. So that part is another $200 a month, $200 and some bucks a month. So when you get your Social Security check, instead of it being $2,500, it's, you know, $2,250 or something. because it's already taken out. Now, you also, if you want to, you can go buy supplemental, and then you can get the drug piece. So when you talk about older people getting all this free stuff, if you do all of that, it's probably in the neighborhood of $580 a month, maybe $600, that you're paying out of pocket. So Medicare is not really, you know, that's so what the hell is that? That's you know, that's $6,000 a year that you're paying in insurance when everybody thinks it's free. Well, it's not free. It's $6,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
That's if you're over 65.
Yeah.
And so the second part is not deductible anywhere or anything like that. All the stuff that comes after. So, I mean, it is amazing how the press will say, well, these people are on Medicare, it's all free. No, it's not.
No, it is not. No. I mean, nothing is free.
No.
Well, maybe, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, let's get this thing. But I must have, Hal says he'd love to talk to the professors down there, because see if any of those guys know what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. With I love, just for, we'll go over a second, I love fighting with Hal, because he is such a pure economist, a perfect competition kind of guy. And by the way, I agree with that 100%. You know, you trade in a trading floor, that's as close as you're ever going to get, right? I agree with that 100%, but I always keep saying, once somebody does one thing to disturb it, all of a sudden you got to do two more things to fix that, two more things to fix the next thing, and then you're not so free anymore. Right?
Right.
So it's we're in this trick bag here between, we're socialist in a couple of spots. Do you guys ever talk about this? We're perfectly competitive in a few spots, and we're sort of fascist in a bunch of other spots. When I say fascist,
because I'm in finance, in the finance department. You know, that's more of an economics discussion. So it doesn't come up in what I do.
Do you guys have just a question for Indiana? Do you have two economics degrees? Because Notre Dame did. They had an economics degree in business, and they had one in arts and letters.
I don't know.
I bet they do.
And that isn't that terrible, but I don't, because there's so many programs and so much going on, and it's such a big place. You know, after a little over 3 years, I'm just not the person to ask about programs.
Well, I bet you have a business.
I'll go to, like, if we've got a thing about, are you interested in getting your MBA at Indiana? I'll actually go to those presentations because I'm trying to learn more about it. But I don't. I know we've got you know, economics within the business school. I don't know if we have it within the in the social sciences or not, like they do at a lot of schools.
I bet you have a business economics degree
and a regular social science one. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I was a social science guy.
Oh, really?
Now, what was the big problem with that?
That doesn't count. No.
But you know, it was such an old time, long ago. That mm-hmm. at Notre Dame, I took all the business classes anyway. You could take them.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like if you go to Illinois for you would get in because you're agricultural economics and trying to take an accounting class, they won't let you.
It doesn't fit.
We're doing
that with the budding meteorologist.
Well, I had
going through the schedules and stuff because she likes dance an awful lot and she's not going to be able to.
Oh, well, I had the full year. With the workbooks, you know, debits to the left and to the right, and I had a full year of accounting, just like a business guy. I had taxes, yeah. I had finance, I had probably 7 or 8 courses in the business school, which mm-hmm. was okay. I just signed up for them. They let you do that. Now I don't think they do.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing at University of Chicago. I was in the business school, and I took half my classes in the economics school. Which I don't, you know, yeah. You can't do if you're going at night or whatever. Anyway, Russell, as usual,
yes,
good
sir.
Stuff. When are you around? Okay, I was your way. We almost called you. Saturday.
Oh, did you? Oh.
I was. You know what? It was an education. I went. Mm-hmm. You know where Berkeley, Illinois is? I never knew of such a place.
Yeah, yeah.
We went to breakfast there with our buddy John, and I couldn't mm-hmm. get on the Eisenhower, and I drove back down Lake Street. Talk about an education.
Oh, isn't that fun?
I had no idea that was such a bombed-out war zone.
Yeah, but beyond that, because I live due west, I hate that we're giving away a secret here, but oh my God, when the Eisenhower is stopped, Lake Street is awesome.
How long does it take before you?
I got home from a Bears game once. Two of us left at the same time from the Loop, and one car went on the Eisenhower, and I took Lake Street, and I think I beat him home by about a half hour.
But it is kind of freaky with those poles so close to you.
Yeah. For people that aren't in Chicago that understand, if you're ever in the Loop, you'll be under the tracks, but there are the Lake Street has an L line that goes straight west. And if you ever see movie scenes or anything else where they're driving for a long period of time under tracks, if they're in Chicago, they're most likely under Lake Street.
The difference is downtown and in part of Lake Street, the supports are sidewalk to sidewalk. So you actually have a full street. When you get out west on Lake Street, they're not. They're only two lanes wide.
No, they're not.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're right next to you.
They're right in the middle of lanes. And, yeah, it's you got to know what you're doing.
Hey, final
–
final
experienced Lake Street driver.
Final economics question. Is oil rally, is this going to last? Is it Armageddon for oil, or is it going right back down when this is over?
I think oil's going to stay elevated. I don't think this thing's going to – this thing's going to last a while.
But it's only $72. It's not all that elevated.
Well, it's going to – it's not going down for me.
You think so? All right, bud. Take care of yourself. Get the daughter on as soon as we can. She can explain hurricanes to me.
Oh my goodness.
S&P futures down 7, ups down 7, Nasdaq up 5. We got a mixed market. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.